All right. Hi, everyone. In the spirit of jagoffery and tomfoolery, I'm going to start with a poem called Good Girls. Good girls don't fuck to Guns N' Roses. They don't lose their virginity in barns, drink malt liquor for dinner, dance in their underwear to social distortion. They don't have sex in parking lots, get high on the drive to Pittsburgh, hike up their dresses for truck drivers. They don't forget to pay the phone bill, smuggle rum into movie theaters, spend the rent money on cocaine. They don't become the other woman, masturbate in the morning, meet the wrong kind of men in bars. They don't mind sleeping alone. This is called Pregnancy is a War Between Mother and Child. At Planned Parenthood, the young girl sitting next to me asks for advice. She can't decide between the abortion pill and the surgical procedure. She's 18, already has one child, another is out of the question. Like me, she is alone, no one to hold her hand, no boyfriend holds her purse while she moves in and out of rooms. Like me, her blood is drawn, she pees in cups. We weigh the pluses and minuses of both choices. I confess that miscarriage alone was difficult, that maybe she should forget the pill which mimics it. Just get it over with today, I say. You're already here. At 10 weeks, I don't have a choice. I don't tell her that I think pregnancy is a war between mother and child. Sometimes there's no clear winner. That this baby is an itch I scratched until the skin broke, making it worse, poisonous infection. That in the stillest hours, not quite considered night, not quite morning, I held my hands on my stomach, splayed in some mother cliche, repeating all the reasons this baby was not a good idea, over and over a mantra. We meet again in the recovery room, as if this is something you can recover from, not something you carry inside of you always. She thanks me for my help. No problem, I say. It's no big deal. So this next poem is a series I've kind of been working on, and some of you who frequent Biddle's Cafe in Regent Square, which is where I, up until today, was living, just moved my last load of stuff out of my apartment, is a gentleman named Lloyd, whose last name we will not mention, but some of you may know him. So this is a series. This is the first poem in the series. Lloyd is a lovely man. If you have the chance to meet him, you should. Lloyd teaches me how to meditate. You gotta imagine a blank white canvas, he says, but make sure it has no edges. I describe my current method, how I imagine a wave coming up over my toes, my legs, my belly, then back down again. Repeat. No good, Lloyd says, there's still movement there. You heard of monkey mind? Trust me, he says. I did this for hours in the desert until I could see the canvas without even closing my eyes. It helps keep you sharp. He surrounds my hands with both of his, squeezes lightly. He says, next time, we work on your circulation. This is newer. I was having a hard time with coming up with stuff to read tonight. This is, reading here is sort of on my bucket list of things, and I'm honored to be here. But I was like, well, some of these people have heard me read some of these same poems over and over again, and so I tried to get a couple new ones. This is one of them. Painting my grandmother's nails. She wanted nail polish for her 96th birthday, preferably pinks and beiges, neutral tones. At the store, pink isn't pink. It's coral, salmon, bubblegum, fuchsia, watermelon, rose, and champagne. I always wanted to name nail polish collections for a living, even if I never wore it. She doesn't remember it's her birthday, but accepts the small bag, slowly pulls each one out, lines them up on the small table next to her bed. She agonizes over the decision. This choice is one of the few they still allow her to make. I have never been good at being a girl, but remember first one brushstroke down the middle, then one on each side. I hold her hand, skin translucent, spotted. Her hand shakes, so does mine. I'm afraid to make a mistake. She was always critical. Her stern judgment follows me like a shadow I cannot shake. When we finish, she looks down, her nails, tiny pink pearls, accenting her fingers. Thank you, Kathleen, she says. The name incorrect, but the sentiment remains. So, like JB, I've got some bar poems, and this is one of them. I mean, we are in a bar, so. Shake. My first real date involved walking almost a mile. My boyfriend arrived in a Batman cape, jester's hat, hair the color of grape Kool-Aid. He bought me grilled cheese. It was June. We were dating because of a spell. He carved my name on a stick, placed the stick in an old mayonnaise jar filled with honey. Every time he shook the jar, I supposedly would think of him. I thought of him 4 years later on another date, the typical kind, where the guy picks you up and there's dinners and movies and flowers involved. I didn't know how to be. I think of him now as I sit across the table from another guy, another failed relationship gone down easy like two buck Budweiser during happy hour special. I think of him whether he still shakes the jar or not. So, some of you know I teach creative writing after school through Pittsburgh Public Schools. Some of you might not know that. One of the lessons I do a lot is a unit on Pittsburgh poetry. I've moved around a lot when I was growing up, with like 18 to 30, and I always kept coming home, and I'm very proud of where I'm from, and I'm very proud to be here. But this is a Pittsburgh poem, because, you know, we're in Pittsburgh. Consolidated Coal Company of Pittsburgh, 1977. This is a true story. Darla Baker was employed by Consolidated Coal, the largest coal company in the United States at the time, and she worked in Wheeling, West Virginia. They called her Deep Throat Darla, the blowjob miner. They spread rumors she worked as a prostitute, kept a mattress deep in the belly of the mine where she offered her services. They tried to rape her underground, pinned her arms to her sides, slammed her against the earth, rubbed her face in the sooty coal dust. When she ran, they tried again. They slashed her tires, felt her up in the break room, their black handprints on her coveralls, a scarlet letter she did not deserve. The boss told her to expect a lot of shit that a pretty girl like her should expect to be grabbed by the ass and boobs. He said, "There's nothing I can do to stop it." So she went higher up, to her local, to her union. She told them the men graffitied the mine walls with chalk, wrote nasty things, drew pinups with large breasts, long hair, spread legs, drew arrows that pointed to where she was working in the mine, a road map for easier access. The union just laughed. "Don't start no shit, Darla," they said, "or you'll be blackballed. Women don't belong anyway." So this is another Lloyd poem. This is based on a true story. Can't make this stuff up. This is called Lloyd Figures Out Poetry, or Ars Poetica. He texts me at 2:52 a.m. The phone vibrates underneath my pillow. "What we call a poem is mostly what is not there on the page," he writes. "The strength of any poem is the poems that it managed to exclude. There's ellipses, some extra spaces. Whew! A stray exclamation point. I'm finally getting it," he says. "No shit." if only poetry was that easy, right? This is Lloyd teaches me how to castrate an alligator. He hands me his business card, which I can show to any of you later if you'd like to see. He hands me his business card, which lists the following: wars fought, bars emptied, revolutions started, tigers tamed, assassinations plotted, computers verified, uprisings quelled, orgies organized, alligators castrated, virgins converted. He says, 7 of those are true, 3 are false. All I know is he is bad with computers. I take the bait, ask about the alligator. It involves a strategically placed rubber band and the alligator's testicles. This constricts blood flow until the unwanted bits turn black and fall off. That's a metaphor, he says, for life. See, he knows metaphors too, right? He's really good. Maybe he's secretly a poet. Okay, so this last one, when I was trying to decide what to read this evening, JB was like, "Oh, so you should include some of your greatest hits." So this is one of my greatest hits. We're going to close it off with this. Dictionary Divinity. In the middle of an argument, a boy I once dated told me I was being brash. "You don't mean brash," I said. "Brash is over-the-top, curvy hips, Bette Midler, truck driver language spewing out through red lips. It's the cleavage shot that seduces from tight black sweaters, sometimes accidental, but not always. It's a cubic zirconium diamond that's a little too big to be real. It's shots of whiskey, sex on the first date, tattoos, and fishnet stockings. I wasn't being brash, I am brash. I was being harsh, and I couldn't want a boy who didn't know the difference." Thank you.